Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Ed Everts. Ed is a leadership coach, an author, host of the podcast Be Brave at Work, and founder of Excellius. And today, I'm excited to dive into our conversation as he shares the research behind and the key concepts from his new book, The Bravery Trick. And our conversation is going to go in lots of directions. We talk about his corporate experience, coaching experience, and of course, the book as well. And one of the things that we'll focus on is what does it take to be more successful in what he refers to as our bravery moments? And through his experience and research, what can we do when we need to talk through topics that are potentially difficult to say or even difficult to hear? His three-step process for preparing for these bravery conversations and his four top tips for being more successful in these bravery conversations. So I really appreciate him sharing his time today, and I'm excited to go through the research with him in the conversation. Thank you all for taking the time to be here with us today. And before we go further, I would love to thank our sponsors. First, we have HumanTel. Please head over to humantel.com. Dive into their research, their blogs, their writing, their white papers, and learn the science behind their training for how to identify when people's emotions are shifting by accurately evaluating their shifting facial expressions and body language, and then what that knowledge can do to help us in all of our conversations. While you're there, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training. I've done it all myself. I highly vouch for it. It's over at humantel.com. Head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to learn more about the International Association of Interviewers. That's where you can find their online and in-person training schedule. That's where you can find all of their interviewer resources. That's where you can see their networking opportunities. It's also where you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to earn the designation? Who qualifies? How do you maintain it? And what could it mean for your career? All that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the custom engagements our clients ask us to facilitate to their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to help them apply the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques necessary to encourage people to share more truthful information with less resistance to make better decisions faster while forging stronger relationships. All that and more at inquasive.com. I appreciate y'all being here again this week. Thank you very much. So now without further ado, Ed Everts. Good morning, Ed. It is so great to see you again. How are you?
I'm doing great, Michael. Thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm excited for our conversation.
It is my pleasure. For those that may not know, you had me on your podcast several times, and they were always great conversations. I really enjoyed them. And now I get to return the favor. Not only are there lots of things I'd love to talk to you about, but you have a new book out, which I'm super excited about, called The Bravery Trick, if I have that correct.
You do. The Bravery Trick, Four Easy Ways to Say Hard Things.
And that is what I'm really looking forward to dive into today, is I think no matter anybody's approach, and I think I made this joke recently with somebody else, even coming from an investigative interviewing background, I don't know anybody, including myself, that wakes up in the morning and says, you know what I want to do today? Have a bunch of really hard conversations. Like that's what I'm really looking forward to in my day. So we all have to have them. And some of us get a little bit more familiar with them than others. But none of us, I don't think, really wake up in the morning and say, this is what I want to spend my day doing. So if I think back to the very first time you interviewed me, I believe the very first question you asked me was, in my opinion, what did it mean to be brave at work? And now I would love to ask you the same question. In light of the new research and all the work that you went putting into your new book, what is your updated definition for what it means to be brave at work?
Well, let me just comment quickly on something you just said, Michael, because I think most people get up in the morning and say, how can I make today as easy as possible and avoid all of these tough things? Every conversation I have with a client, there is a tough conversation I need to have, and they vary based on content and relationships, et cetera. But you know, most of us do have brave moments in our lives. We either have lived them, are living them, or will live them and impact all of us. So when I think about bravery, and this comes from, as you said, the survey I conducted, the work that I've done with clients over the last 16 years, my 20 years in leadership roles and organizations, to me, bravery at work is really about saying something that you believe is hard to say, so it's hard to get it out of your mouth, or you believe will be hard for the other person to hear. And anytime you have that feeling where what you need to say is hard to say, or you think is hard for that person to hear, is what I consider to be a bravery moment.
And in those moments, I imagine, well, actually, let me ask you this in the form of a question. There is the apprehension prior, and then there's potentially the relief and or satisfaction after. How do you see people either struggling or improving to balance out that equation and not just get swept up by the apprehension?
Well, it's almost as if, and I know you haven't read my book yet, but it's almost as if you've read it, because I talk about, after you say something that you believe will be hard to say, or you think might be hard for that person to hear, and you get through it, oftentimes clients go back to their office and do like a cheerleader jump. They feel so good that they finally said something professionally and respectfully, right? We're not talking about hitting someone across the head with a 2x4, but, how do I professionally, respectfully talk with you about something that's hard for me to talk about or maybe hard for you to hear that can help? And when I do that, I feel great. So I wish we could flip the feelings, and that positiveness and sense of accomplishment can come first and then be repeated after you do it, as opposed to kind of that sense that you're describing of apprehension that people feel. At the book launch that we just hosted recently, I did a quick exercise during my comments section where I jokingly said to people, after my comments this evening, we're going to randomly pick 10 of you to come up on stage one at a time and tell your bravery story. And then I was silent for a moment and I said, we're not going to do that, but I want you to feel what you're feeling right now, because many of you are probably getting a little tense. You're getting butterflies in your stomach. Your back is straightening. You got hairs tingling on your neck. The temperature in the room is rising, right? That's the bravery moment that we encounter. And that's the bravery trick. It's our body trying to trick us into not saying something that's hard to say or you think might be hard to hear. And oftentimes it prevails and we don't say those types of things. So in some ways, I wish we could flip what you had just described and move it from knowing what I need to say will help you significantly.
Wouldn't it be great if we could find that button hidden somewhere and just flip it for everybody? When you have said things that can be difficult to say and or things that can be difficult to hear, because I imagine in some situations, both elements can be present, or maybe just one element can be present. It's hard for me to say, wouldn't be hard for you to hear, hard for you to hear, not hard for me to say, or both. It's hard for me to say and hard for you to hear. I guess if we could pick one at a time, when we start with the hard to say, what in your research have you found to be some of the biggest fears or the biggest risks that hold people back from professionally stating things that are important and can move relationships or teams or initiatives forward?
Yeah, I think in the research that we did, the two that I would mention are, one, I don't know how to say what it is that I want to say, right? I have this feeling, I have a belief about something I should tell you that I think would be helpful for you or that I think that you should know, but I don't know how to say it. I don't know how to articulate it in the way that I think would be helpful. The second reason is fear of damaging the relationship. You and I might get along great, and then suddenly I say, hey, can I give you some feedback on something that I think if I were you, I would want to hear? And then suddenly I worry that it's not going to be great, especially in a kind of subordinate boss relationship where I want to give a boss feedback. Well, everyone wants their boss to love them. Am I now about to damage that relationship? And so those were the reasons most people identified. Five or six reasons, but the two most dominant were lack of ability to say what it was I wanted to say in a very professional and respectful way. And I do stress the importance of any time that you're giving somebody feedback, you have to be perceived as being helpful. If you're not being helpful, if you're judging or belittling or trying to prove you're right, getting argumentative, it's not going to be helpful. The person's not going to listen to you and it will not be a productive conversation. So ensuring that I know what it is that I want to say. And then not fearing that the relationship will be damaged can be very, very helpful in the pre-conversation or the pre-talk you have to give yourself before you have the bravery conversation with a colleague.
I can relate to both of those directly. And maybe, sadly, I feel like I relate to them more in my personal life than in my professional life. Like in my professional life, it's a job. It's the responsibility. It's what we do. So, okay, gulp, here we go. Think it through. But like in the personal life, I feel like there's more to lose. The consequences are greater, which is ironic because I believe my wife and I have a tremendous relationship. And I believe my son and I have a fantastic relationship. And I believe my family and close friends, well, we've stuck it out for 20 plus years for most of us that are friends at this point. So we're good. But I still feel like those fears tend to weigh more, at least for me personally, on the personal side than the professional side. Did any of that check out in your research, or am I just on an island there with that?
No, you're not on an island. And I'm not suggesting the model that I've created and the recommendations I have are going to solve every bravery opportunity that comes up. I do believe that life is, you know, more of a war than a battle. And so sometimes there are battles you just give up on, right? That you don't believe you'll make progress on, or no matter what you say, and no matter how respectful and professional, it's not going to move the dial in a way that you want. I do believe that there are many we should be having. And so my goal is to kind of move the dial a little bit to ensure that if there's something you should hear that I think would be helpful to you, whether you do something with it or not, or choose to, I can't control, but it's important that you know that. And when I think of the work that you do, Michael, in respect to, you know, being the disciplined listener, a lot of time, I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is spent thought of how to ask this question, where do I want to take this conversation? What is important that we talk? You know, you work on that a lot. Is that true in respect to the work that you do?
It's very true. And it's taken that outcome that we're looking for and working backwards. So depending on the situation, how valuable is the relationship? How valuable is the initiative? What other interactions are we going to have in between? Once we achieve this outcome, what's next? And so it's really trying to play that long game and understand when and how do opportunities present themselves to provide the proper feedback in the framework where someone's more likely to internalize it. And then put it to good use, even if they don't do it right now, even if they kind of look at me like they're chewing through a piece of steel, but they walk away. And even if they never acknowledge it, but 2 weeks later, you can see the behavior is changing, then good. You know, that's what we were looking for. So I think that was a great connection. Thank you.
Yeah. And look, you just touched on and described it beautifully, some of the pre-work that has to happen. And in the book, I talk about three things that must exist before you even have a bravery conversation. So if these things don't exist, don't do it, right? Because if they don't exist, the likelihood of the conversation unfolding in the way that you want is going to be marginalized. And so those three things are, A, you have to ensure that you understand your motivation. Like, why do I want to say what I need to say to Michael? I know it's going to be hard for me to say. I think it'll be hard for him to hear. But, you know, I need to be very clear on why. Because if I don't know why, or I'm not thinking the long game or the relationship, it's not going to work. Two, I need to ensure that I'm being helpful, right? I want to give Michael the impression that I'm there to help. If I'm being there to judge or belittle, it's not going to work. So I would imagine in your work, again, I think you want to ensure that the person you're speaking to believes that you're trying to help move something forward, right? You're not trying to capture them or prove something technically or not necessarily, but you want to ensure that you are helping it move forward.
Definitely. What was the third one?
So the third one, Michael, is the need to have a positive relationship. We've talked about this so far, right? So it's so important that you are not having a conversation that damages or puts the relationship now on a new set of rails that wasn't the way that you intended it to go. So if you're there to help the person, you know, your motivation for speaking with them, and you have a positive relationship with them, that's so important. So in today's world, you know, we are very quietly moving from a hierarchical world where there's boss to boss to boss to boss to a world where relationships are much more important. You know, people do want to know about the fact that you have kids and things that you're doing. And I call it the LinkedIn influence, right? Where suddenly now you can see a picture of everyone and you know, where they went to college and what their interests are, right? It's adding this flavor to it. So it's important to have positive relationships with people at work, not necessarily deep relationship, but positive relationships. Because if I come to you and say, Michael, I'd like to talk to you about something I observed today that I think would be important for you to hear, and we have a positive relationship, your likelihood of saying, absolutely, sounds great. If we don't have a positive relationship, or I don't even know you, it's not going to work as well.
Oh, certainly not. And your points lead me to kind of a parallel train of thought, I think, and that for the leaders listening to the call, it's important for us to create the opportunities to feel like others can be brave with us. Like if we lay the groundwork and we seize the opportunity to either encourage feedback from others or demonstrate, like give people proof that when they gave us tough feedback, it was okay. Even if we disagree with it, it was okay. No harm, no foul. We can all move on. Now people will be more brave in those critical moments. I was working with a group last year, and one of the CEOs in the room commented that he felt like his relationships with employees got better when he realized there was a glass ceiling to how much people would trust him just because of his title. There's nothing he could do about it. So instead of taking it personal anymore, he just came to grips with, well, I'm a CEO and there's only so far that people are going to be willing to trust me based on the consequences that I could have in their life. So with that mindset, he started interacting with people differently, which led to them being more relaxed and sharing more information with him over time. So even as leaders, we can do a better job creating the environment where down the road, people feel more comfortable being brave with us. I don't know if that ties into your research and your work and your book.
Well, it does on two fronts. One, you're talking about what I believe is the core leadership development skill, which is self-awareness. Regardless of my role in an organization, I need to be highly self-aware on how people experience me. Again, I don't have to do anything about it. I don't have to like it, you know, whatever it might be, but this is how they experience you in the workplace. And then you go to self-management, which is now you manage that, which is exactly what you're talking about with that CEO. They were self-aware on how people were experiencing them and then managing it in ways that hopefully are productive and helpful. At the end of the book, I talk about the idea of culture and creating an environment where bravery is welcome. So it would be very hard for me to be brave with you in an organization that doesn't recognize, honor, or appreciate bravery at all. And in fact, you know, water cooler talk is, well, don't talk to Michael because if he's upset with you, it'll just be bad news, right? This is what happens oftentimes in organizations. So as a leader, and I encourage organizations to really find a way to integrate being brave with each other. And we're not talking about, you know, Hollywood bravery. You know, when people hear the word bravery, that, you know, they think of Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible and things of that nature. But, you know, we're talking about small conversations. Maybe you don't talk up enough at meetings, right? Not world-changing activities. But, you know, I heard this about a client today, and he believes it's cultural on the part of a colleague who at meetings doesn't say a word. And at the first meeting, it may not be an issue, but meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, it's now becoming observational that this person doesn't talk, right? So this is a bravery opportunity that you can speak up, but they need to create this environment, role model this environment to ensure that people are welcome. And if I know you welcome it and I've seen you do it, I welcome it as a leader, my likelihood of doing it with you and with others is significantly greater.
Creating that environment is so important. Expecting people to behave in a way that we haven't laid the groundwork for, we haven't been clear about, we haven't made acceptable, we haven't reinforced. We're getting frustrated for them for not behaving in a way that we haven't made it okay to behave. So as leaders, that's super important. To circle back just a bit, you several times, you've mentioned the importance of being professional and responsible, or respectful, not responsible. I guess responsible goes into it, but professional and respectful, helpful, wanting to make sure that we're trying to move something forward in our feedback and not being judgmental, not being ridicule, not out to win, any of those things. So, and I want to be careful because I don't want to take too much from your book. I know in an hour we couldn't talk through it all anyway, but I want to be very respectful of the work you put into your book. From a highlight perspective, what are some of the techniques or best approaches that you've found for people to give that feedback while staying within the guardrails you mentioned?
Well, the subtitle of the book is Four Easy Ways to Say Hard Things. And yeah, you know, I'll share what those four are, because I think those are the strategies that I heard from guests on my podcast, Be Brave at Work. as well as the survey that we conducted. And again, my own experience as a leadership coach working with leaders for the last 16 years and then 20 years in the workplace. And none of these are what we call brain surgery, right? So I'm not going to suggest things that's like, oh my God, I never thought of that before. You know, the first one is practice. There are very few things in life you will get better at if you don't practice it. And whether it's sports or speaking or math, you know, whatever it might be, unless you do it again and again and again, you'll just not get better at it. And so there's a couple of ways that you can practice, which is, you know, once you know your motivation to speak with you is to help you and is important based on our relationship, that this is something that we want to do. The first thing I need to do is just get the thoughts out of my head, because the head can be a very dangerous place. It's filled with millions of ideas, and these ideas are also in there, right? So let me pull these out and, you know, in a very informal way on my own, just on a white sheet of paper, just write down what it is I'm feeling, how I think this will be helpful. And, you know, I give some tips and ideas on how to do that. And then the second thing to do with practice is to find an accountability partner, which is, you know, hey, Michael, I need to talk to Ed about something in a couple of weeks. I wanted to run by you what it is I'd like to say confidentially. I'd love your reaction. You know, does it sound good? Is there another way I could say it? Am I hitting any trigger words that you think are going to set Ed off? You know, I need your help because I want to be as prepared as possible. The first time you have a conversation with a boss or a colleague or a subordinate where you need to be brave should not be with that person. I mean, that is not the time that you do it. It's like, you know, you don't play the Masters and never played golf before, right? So, you know, it's something that you need to kind of work through a little bit. I'll tell you the other three, but I'll just pause there for a second to see if you have any questions or if you want to talk about, you know, practice any further.
I couldn't agree more. It's, you can use any sports analogy. You can use any public speaking analogy. There's plenty of them out there. But not only do the first time I do it, I don't want to be with that person if we don't have the relationship prior. But the first time I say the words, I don't want to be saying those words. So even if I don't have an accountability partner, whether it is just pacing in my house or taking a walk and saying it out loud, I don't think people understand always or frequently that when we talk out loud, we're building muscle memory. That's different than saying it in your head just to yourself. So like even saying it out loud and getting comfortable with delivering the message that way. So the practice is critical. I'll tell a super quick version of a story. When I taught interrogation, one of my, shout out to my friend Chris and former teammate who conducted a great interrogation. And the suspect was described to us as somebody who was a lifelong sales senior executive, multinational clients. He's been the sales executive for over 30 years, smart, witty, sarcastic, confident, you know, all these things, right? But he's suspected of committing fraud. Okay, cool. So based on that, Chris wanted to practice the night before, which we all did. So I'm not saying that's a Chris thing. So I got to be the one who got to pretend to be the arrogant, sarcastic, confident. So basically, I got to sit 4 feet in front of Chris and be the biggest jerk I could think of for about 45 minutes. So when we would teach that video, we would tell people like before we showed it, okay, this is the subject. This is what we've learned. This is what we suspect. This is, by the way, none of the evidence that we wish we had. We don't have any of it. So here's everything we think we got. Let's see how Chris does. And then he gets a $250,000 fraud confession out of the guy. And after, people would be like, well, why did you make that sound so hard? That was really easy. Well, why do you think it looks so easy? Like, Chris practiced. He had a strategy. He had outcomes in mind. He had it researched to the degree that he could, the person he was going to speak with. And he had put himself in a position where he had already dealt with what he would have to deal with during the conversation. So here I am stealing your work. I want to get back to focusing on you and your book. But when you were talking about the importance of practice, you know, my mind immediately went to that conversation and the reaction it got.
Yeah, no, it's a great example. You're not stealing any ideas. And sports are just very visible because they're on TV all the time. And
yeah,
like I could do that, but you don't see behind the scenes the thousands of hours they're spending practicing. Acting is not much different. You know, mm-hmm. You don't see all the hours that the actors, and they do what they call table reads, where they get all of the actors together prior to any movie, even filming a scene, and they just read through the lines, right? Because they want to start feeling the character and feeling the emotion. Having a brave conversation is not easy. And so you want to be as prepared as possible. And you don't want the first time you say something to somebody that's hard to say, maybe hard for them to hear, with them, right? You want to do it in advance. So
Great
the second,
point.
Yeah, the second area is what I call presence. And so this is what I call being all in, which is if I'm going to sit with you and talk to you about something that I think is hard for me to talk about, and I'll tell somebody, this is very hard for me to talk about with you, Michael, because I've never had this conversation with somebody before. So I hope it comes out in the way that I mean it, or I think maybe hard for you to hear. I have to be all in. So no technology, no, you know, windows with people walking by, no, you know, no distractions. And I have a notepad. I'm taking notes because I want to remember exactly what both of us said. Not detailed notes per word, but, you know, keywords you used or that I used. Easier for playback. Gee, a few minutes ago, you used that word. Why did you use that word? That type of thing. But the second behavior that you want to demonstrate in a brave conversation is that you are all in, that you are demonstrating great presence. Because I feel as the person you're speaking with that you're all in, like I'm saying to myself, wow, he is all in on this conversation. I'm more likely to be all in, right? I'm going to honor that, not just be dismissive, but I'm going to play and role model what you're role modeling with me, which is being all in as well.
Agreed. Definitely. And it can be hard. Don't even put, if you're going to have that conversation, don't even put your phone in your pocket.
Yeah.
Because then when it vibrates or dings and you're like, who's that? Who's that? Who's that? Who's that? And now you're not present anymore.
Yeah. I've had tough conversations with people and they were having the tough conversation with me and we were in their office and their phone's ringing. They kept looking. And yeah, I'm like, you're not here, right? You're saying something to me that's hard for you to talk about or maybe hard for me to hear, but you're not here, right? You're just doing this as part of your job. So I do believe in order to have a brave conversation that is effective, you want to practice, you know, get the thoughts out of your head, run it by a colleague. And by the way, an accountability partner always sounds like an official title. It could be a spouse. It could be a brother. It could be a sister. It could be a colleague. It could be anyone, right? That can say, hey, I need to have a tough conversation with somebody. I just want to run you by how I'm going to present it. Can you just tell me how it makes you feel? Right? Anybody can give you that. So the third area, we talked about practice and presence. The third area is future focus. And so this is super important because, you know, we can sit back and discuss everything that did happen for hours, but never talk about what it is you need to do differently going forward in order to be more effective, which is the whole goal of why I was speaking with you in the first place. So this is not meant to be a criminal investigation where I'm trying to find out exactly what happened. What happened, happened. I can't change what happened. But let me tell you a little bit about how it may have made others feel. And let's talk about what you could do differently going forward in order to have a different outcome. And this is super important because we don't like having brave conversations. And so the easier place to go to is what we know about, which is what's happened. And so we will talk ad nauseum about what happened and never have any type of impact on the person that you're speaking with. So staying future focused, you can always reflect a little bit. Person needs to know why you're there and, you know, what it is that you want to talk with me about. But you quickly have to shift to being future focused and what you think outcomes might be that can help that person have a different outcome.
I'm loving all of this. And I especially love that word outcome. In my experience, which I think really overlaps strongly with your research and experience and what you're talking about, encouraging people to accept ideas, feedback, suggestions that aren't theirs or they might initially disagree with, that process becomes much easier when it's framed around an outcome they want to achieve. If it's just, you know what, Ed, I've been watching you and I don't think you realize, I don't think you're good. I think you're messing up. I don't believe I'm sounding judgy. I believe I'm giving you my feedback, but man, I am just hammering you with judgment, even though in my mind, I think I'm trying to help. But now if we can say, you know what, Ed, over the last several months, we've been working through these team meetings together. It's my perception that this is the outcome we're really trying to achieve. Yeah, Mike, you're right. Great. Well, on our way to achieve that outcome, now we can get into that feedback. We're blame-free. We're judgment-free. We're not beating dead horses. At least for me, and I'd love your thoughts on this, one of the biggest shifts I've seen people make in successfully resolving everything from investigations to performance management to relationships that have gone off the rails is getting over needing the confession. The I did it, I knew it was wrong. I'm sorry. Like, you don't necessarily need all that. Maybe sometimes in an investigation, but actually a lot of times in an investigation, you don't need all of that either. Especially in the business conversations we're talking about. If we can get over the ego, I need to hear Ed say he was wrong. He knows it. He's sorry. It'll never happen again. Good luck getting there without judgment and embarrassment. So if we can let that go and focus on the outcome, like you just said, man, I feel like the stress levels drop and the success levels skyrocket.
Yeah. And you're actually leading me to the fourth behavior. But before we get there, a little bit about what you're talking about is what I call using softer language. And so I would never speak with somebody and say, always, you always do this, or you're all right. Because I might, what's the first thing I'm going to do? I'm going to say, well, no, it's not always right. I'm going to get defensive. Right. So I love saying sometimes, or it's possible, or some people, not ever, always, right? Because as soon as you say you always are, you always do, you're going to lose them instantly because they know that's impossible, right? But if you say, hey, sometimes some people from time to time might, it sounds a little softer, and their likelihood of saying, yeah, it's possible that sometimes some people, now they're playing, you know, along with you a little bit better than they would have been if you were to, you know, black and white or objective about the feedback that you're giving. So the fourth behavior, so we talked about practice, we talked about presence, we talked about future focus, is flexibility. I almost forgot it there for a second. So flexibility is exactly what you were just talking about. And this is the beauty of the whole model. I don't have to have the answer. I could tell you this is how people are experiencing you at work, some people. And this might be the impact that it's having on them. Do you see this from time to time, right? We walk through the conversation where they say, yeah, I can see that from time to time. Well, gee, Michael, what can you do differently in order to have a different outcome? And they're going to have one of three answers, which is either, well, here's two or three things I could do, or here's one thing, or I don't know, right? And what, regardless of what that is, you do not have to have the answer. You do not have to be the James Bond of solutions who comes in and says, well, here's what you have to do. Right. So you want to be, you want to practice what it is that you want to say. You want to make sure you're being future focused. You want to be present with the person, but you do not have to have the outcome, even if it means, well, I'd love you to think a little bit about it, Michael, and let's meet again in a week. And I'd love for you to think about what are two or three things that you could be doing differently in order to have a different outcome. All on them, because quite frankly, it's not your behavior that you need to modify. It's their behavior. Right. And if they're just doing what they were told, their likelihood for changing it is diminished. If they're doing something they thought of to say, hey, Ed, I had a great idea. Here's something that I could do starting next week that I think will have a greater impact. Their likelihood of doing it is significantly greater. So flexibility, this arena where you can open the door to multiple outcomes, even ideas they might have that you didn't even consider, is a great way to help ensure that the brave conversation that you're having has a wonderful outcome.
Love to circle back to the outcome. Again, totally on board with what you're saying, and to maybe piggyback on it and steer me where you need to steer me. I also feel like going into these conversations, there's always something we don't know. So if you and I have had a series of interactions, I've made my observations and I decide, okay, there's feedback I probably really should share with Ed. I think it'd be really helpful, would help us achieve these outcomes. I don't know, maybe you've received instruction or you're modeling your behavior after somebody else. I don't know. Maybe there's been some conversations behind closed doors with other people that I haven't been a part of. So I'm reacting to a very small portion of this big picture. I don't know. Maybe you're experiencing extra stress because somebody else in the organization, a board member or a CEO or a donor or somebody with influence is coming in and saying, hey, this is what we need you to do. And it's not comfortable. It's not part of the role you signed up for. Things going on in somebody's personal life. God forbid there's an issue in somebody's marriage or health or whatever it might be. So being flexible in the approach allows us to learn those things, because then somebody else, instead of getting defensive and saying, well, I'm not wrong. You don't know the story. I don't always do that. Staying away from always is so important, or never, you know, the sisters there, always and never. But allowing people to share the additional context then allows us to arrive at a better solution potentially together. And that better solution could be, you know what, Ed? I wasn't aware. My only intentions were to be helpful. Thank you for helping me understand. Okay, maybe we learned. or now we can move forward together.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite quotes comes from Stephen Covey's book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And in that, he has seven habits. And habit number five is seek first to understand, then to be understood, right? Unfortunately, in corporate America, we tend first to think that we try to be understood. And then if we have enough time, I'll try to understand, you know, where you're coming from. So the first thing you want to do is certainly say, hey, here's some feedback I've received from some others. I'd like to share with you it for a few minutes. It may be hard for you to hear, but we're just here to talk about it. I want to help you. I share some of the feedback and then I go into inquiry mode. Tell me a little bit about what you're thinking, what's going on, right? Give them the opportunity to say, like you were just saying, gee, I never realized that. That's not the experience that I had, or yeah, I'm that way on purpose, you know, whatever it might be. But during my 20 years in human resources, you know, I ultimately developed a mental model, which was hope for the best, expect the worst. And I don't mean in my own behavior, but with the person I was speaking to, sometimes they might get angry. Sometimes they might cry. Sometimes they might get up and walk. I mean, who knew what the reaction might be to it? I talk in the book a little bit about always having the ability, and throughout the conversation, whether you're, you know, after you practice, whether you're being present and future focused, you always have the ability to pause it. You always have the ability to say, hey, Michael, this isn't going the way that I hoped it would go. So why don't we take a couple of minutes? If you want to get up, stretch your legs for a little bit and let's come back. But you always have the ability to pause it. It is not a TV show where you only have 27 minutes and you got to get through it. And you're bam, 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 bam. And the person isn't enjoying it and it's not going well. So you can pause it for a couple of minutes. You could pause it for a day, right? Whatever you need to do, you always have the ability to pause. And I say pause and not stop, because to me, pause means you still keep going. Stop means you stop and you're not going any further. But you want to pause it to ensure that you're having the outcome that you intended, right? And if it's not going the way that you thought because you were surprised, okay, let's remodify what we're doing. Let's think a little bit about the impact this is having and go back at it again.
Another great point. Time is the enemy of empathy. No matter who we're talking to and what we're talking about, if my priority is beating the clock, everything else is screwed. Because now my emotions, my reactions, everything's going to be based off of where am I against the clock, not where am I in relation to our relationship, to the outcomes that we're working to achieve. You mentioned as part of that illustration that other people might react in different ways. They get angry, they cry, they shut down, they get frustrated. And all we have our emotions as well, whether it's the fear and apprehension, or even as we're retelling a story, the emotion that we felt at the time. You know, you mentioned actors getting used to feeling the emotion. If something happened between you and I that made me feel real sad or real frustrated or real angry, even though in the moment I feel like I'm composed when I start the conversation, when I get to that part in the story, it can be expected that those emotions become very real again as I retell them. So in your work, how have you helped people control their emotions isn't the right way to say it. How have you helped people maybe accept or harness or work around their emotions as they have these bravery conversations?
Yeah, and I wouldn't attempt ever to help someone kind of work around their emotions. A couple of things that I would do, and I think you're, you know, I love that phrase that time is the enemy of empathy. You know, bravery conversations as part of the presence model requires empathy. It's not about you. It's about them. You feel it's about you because, right, you believe your performance is being judged, but it's not about you. It's about them. And I would always set context. Hey, Michael, we've got a half hour to catch up. I hope we can conclude our conversation with that next half hour. If we don't, we'll continue it, right? Because I don't want them to feel like I'm being managed by the clock. There may be some influences I need to honor, but I don't want them to feel like, hey, I got 5 minutes. I'm about to hit you over the head with a 2x4 and then have a great day, right? And then I'm extremely observant, right? So some people, you can physically tell when something is upsetting to them. You know, some people have that thing where their neck gets red, right? There is a medical term for it. I can't remember what it is. But, you know, some people very physically can tell you, or they'll start crying. You can see tears forming in their eyes, right? In respect to the conversation that you're having. So you want to be very, very empathetic. If you ignore it, again, because you're trying to beat the clock and just drive through it, it won't be the conversation that you hoped it would have been, right? You want to ensure that you're being very present And presence isn't just about your presence, but the presence of the other person that they're in, that they understand what you're talking about, and are using this information to possibly make choices that will be helpful to them.
For sure. If we're having a conversation with somebody, that means we have a future together. I mean, I guess unless you're terminating them, then a lot of these rules still apply, but you don't
have they all apply, but right.
But you're talking to them because you have a future together. And if I have a future together because I'm choosing it, or if it's a boss subordinate relationship and we have a future together because I don't have a choice, we still have a future together. So if the point of this conversation is about improving the future, it should never be about, I had to get this done in 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes. And some of that even comes down to, you talked about self-awareness, situational awareness. There's no such thing as a perfect time, but when is a good time or a better time to try to schedule the conversation? And when's a good venue? Is it good for me to come and sit in your office? Is it good for me to invite you to my office? Is it good to sit in the conference room? Is it good to go for a walk, to go get a cup of coffee, to go get a lunch? Like, all of these things can impact how somebody experiences the conversation.
Yeah, we talk a little bit about the value of the difference. And so if I want to have a different conversation with you, let's say we've worked together for 5 years and we've never had a sour word between us, and I've now been observing something at a meeting that I think you should know about, let's go to lunch. You know, maybe that's just different for us to go to lunch, maybe go to breakfast, because if you're in a different environment, having a different conversation will make more sense than in the same environment that we're always in, right? So is it super critical? It's not super critical. You may still need to be brave with somebody, even if you can't be. But if you have that opportunity to create a different environment or feeling, you definitely should go for it. And we talk about that in the book as well. The room that you're in, we talk about how you sit at a table. So if you're at a boardroom table, sit on the same side, sit across, you know, next to the person and not across the table. A lot of people just sit on opposite sides of the table. You know, you want to sit on the same side with the person, bodies facing each other. It's presence, right? That you're present for the meeting, you're present for them, and you want them to feel that so that they participate in the conversation as well.
Thank you so much for saying that. Thank you so much.
That was out of plan.
Yeah. Don't sit across the con, especially if like you're in one of these, you know, 40 person conference tables and you sit on the other side, like, come on. Also, especially if you're in a superior position, sitting behind your desk when somebody else comes in is going to not be helpful. Even just the phrase, come in, sit down, shut the door, puts people on fear street. So just being careful with how we approach the room setting is so important. I think that's an aspect that people overlook constantly. Well, this is my office, so this is where I talk. This is my seat at the conference room table, so this is where I sit. Well, like you just said, this ain't about you. This is about creating the experience the other person needs to drive the behavioral change that you're looking for. So I love it.
Yeah. And you just mentioned something that I love as well, which is, especially when I was an HR leader and somebody came into my office because I had to have a brave conversation with them. And by the way, I am not the bravest person ever created. At the book launch we hosted, I gave 3 stories where I was not brave at work. I still think about them today, and some of them are 20 years old. I mean, these are things that happened 20 years ago, and I still think of them today, regretfully, wishing that I didn't do it. But, you know, when someone came into my office, either they would say, do you want the door opened or closed? And I'd say, gee, if you could close it, that would be great. If they just came in and sat down, I would never say, oh, by the way, can you close the door? I would get up, because I would also sit outside front of my desk. I'd never sit behind my desk. And while I was up, I would go and I would quietly close the door, right? But that's presence, right? These are small indicators of presence, that what am I creating physically and spiritually in some ways in the meeting to ensure that this isn't some kind of knockdown, drag out fight, but a good conversation, because I want to help you. I have to give you the impression and lead you to believe in the ways I say it and the way that I act, that I am here to help, not blame, judge, belittle, insult, be right, but to help you.
And all those things are super important. Even as silly as it sounds, asking their permission, hey, do you mind if I shut the door?
Yeah.
They're going to say yes, but now they're in control. I was working with a group a couple of weeks ago, and I talked with 5 people in one day, and I asked every single one of them if I had their permission to take notes. Now, statistically speaking, they're all going to say yes. But just the respect that that shows resets the tone of the conversation, as opposed to pulling out my notepad and just writing as soon as they start talking. That doesn't feel good for anybody. So those little steps make a big difference. So you did mention having a few times that you still look back on, the situations that you felt like you wish you could have handled differently. You have three. I might have about three storage facilities full of those examples and stories, things I wish I handled a little bit differently. I know you just told them at the book launch that you only had a couple of days ago, but if there was one that you felt maybe you were okay sharing in this venue, and then maybe even more importantly, what have you taken from that experience and how has that driven you to where you are today in the skills that you help other people learn to acquire?
Yeah, so I shared three stories at our book launch, but like you, I've got dozens. I've got dozens and dozens and dozens of stories. And there's some today that I need to do that I'm either avoiding or thinking about how to do. And there's some around the corner that I can't even anticipate right now. But you know, I think in our time, I'd love to share with you the second story I shared, which is about a client who was not brave with me, right? So this wasn't about my bravery, but the bravery of a client. And to truncate the story, I was hired to host a two-day group meeting. So I was facilitating a two-day meeting, an all-day Thursday and a half-day Friday. At the end of Thursday, I thought things were going pretty well. Friday, things seemed to be a little bit awkward, but you know, I thought maybe it was just the end of the week and people were tired, whatever. Meeting ended. I went home. This was down in Manhattan. And then 2 weeks later, the president of the company I was working for, so I was doing this facilitation through another company, called me and said, hey, Ed, how's it going? I said, great. And she goes, I just spoke with the client from this major retailer. This is a large retailing organization in the U.S. And I have some feedback for you. And I said, great. And she started with, well, to be candid with you, they hated you. And I said, wow, I'm surprised. I can imagine that, you know, I can't ensure everybody loves me, but I don't think I did anything that would require the hate. But the lesson is that I take from that is after Thursday, the first day, if in fact things weren't going well, they could have pulled me aside and said, hey, Ed, can we talk to you for a couple of minutes? We'd love to give you some feedback and some observations we had from today and some things that we think would be good for us to do tomorrow so we can hit the cover off the ball. I would have said, absolutely, let's talk about it, right? But here's the president of this national global retailer and this chief human resource officer, neither of them said anything. So they decided not to say anything, come back on Friday, have an awkward meeting because they didn't think I was doing a great job, and go home. And so I share that story because I want people to know it happens at all levels. That just because you're president of a large firm doesn't make you suddenly super brave and say things that would be helpful for each other. They didn't figure out why to be helpful for me. They weren't motivated to be helpful with me. We didn't have a relationship because I just met them. So some of the pieces were missing, but it can happen to any of us at any time.
It sure can. And I appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you very much. And I can think back over my career, too, when people have thankfully pulled me aside. I'm sure there's times where they haven't, but have thankfully pulled me aside. And whether it was, Mike, that joke really wasn't right for this group, or, you know, the examples you're using don't necessarily line up with what we do, or, you know, any number of those, it gives us the chance to correct it. And if they don't, you're right. We just keep doing the same thing we've always done because it worked before. Why wouldn't it work now? And there's always accountability to go around. But one of the things I feel like, when I'm listening to people share stories, like somebody else was facilitating a meeting or somebody else led a conversation or somebody else, and I had the chance to positively impact it, but I didn't. And now I'm blaming them entirely for a negative experience. They might still bear the brunt or the majority of the accountability because they were in charge from the start and it was their experience. Okay, fine. But if we had the opportunity to impact that and we didn't take it, then we have to own some of that accountability as well. Yeah. So as you look back over some of these experiences, how has that really motivated you to be where you are now in order to help so many of us approach these conversations more productively?
Well, two things. One, it's motivated me to manage group and facilitation opportunities a little bit differently. So at the end of each day, whether it's a 2 day or 3 day or even a 1 day, I will always go up to the meeting owner. There's always one person who kind of owns the meeting and say, hey, I'd love some feedback on today. What do you think went well? What do you think I might do differently? I feel a little guilty that I didn't do that with this client. I did it in the morning after an exercise. I thought it went great, but apparently the rest of the day might not have. So, I do own that. You know, change starts with yourself. And so if you want it to be a little bit different, it's important to do that. You know, this is a fairly recent example. It just happened about a year ago. So, you know, that would be my huge takeaway, which is don't let people's perception of you sit just with them. You've got to look for it. Right. So just because they're not saying anything doesn't mean they're happy or not happy. I assumed because they didn't come to speak to me that they were happy. Well, it was an incorrect assumption because apparently they weren't happy. Right. So I think that's important as well. Sometimes you have to look for bravery and pull it out by saying, hey, what did you think about today? Oh, yeah, I'm really glad you asked. I don't know if today was exactly what we were expecting. Tell me about it. I'd love to know. So tomorrow I can rectify what we're doing and again, have people leave feeling great and not feeling like, oh, I'm so glad we got out of there.
And accepting whatever they say on face value.
Absolutely.
Resisting the urge to push back. And well, you know, that we're going to do that. That was scheduled for tomorrow. Or that's not how I meant it. Or that's not what I said it. Or well, that's not what you asked me to do when we signed the contract. Like all of these things that might feel like valid points at the time are meaningless here. And I feel like that's a lesson I had to learn the hard way. Playing sports when I was younger, the coach would yell at me for something and I would remind him that I thought I was doing what he asked me to do 5 minutes ago. And that would only cause me to run more laps and do more pushups. So eventually I had to learn, just take it on the chin and move on. Yeah. You mentioned the survey that you did a bunch of times too. So I greatly appreciate you sharing the example from your own personal experience. What were some of the either examples or themes that jumped out at you from the survey that we can all learn from and apply as well?
Yeah, the first one is the most significant, which is that of the people that participated, 96% of them believed that there were bravery opportunities in their past that they didn't take advantage of. So I believe bravery moments exist for all of us. I haven't researched the world to confirm that, but I think every time I talk about it, everyone's head goes up and down because we have all had opportunities where we didn't say something because it was too hard to say, or we were afraid how the person would hear it, or we have something right now that we're avoiding and procrastinating on because we don't know what to say or how they're going to receive it, or there's something waiting around the corner, right? So we know that. But, you know, 96% of the people did that. And the vast majority of people felt, for example, that they would have made more progress being brave if they had had more training. And so we talk a little bit about why we're not brave, and it is not personal. It's not like Michael isn't brave because of Michael, but it's our culture. You know, we did not go to school to learn how to be brave. You know, junior high, high school, and college, we didn't take courses on how to be brave. You know, we learned nothing about how to be brave. And then you go to work, and on the first day, they're like, oh, you've got to talk to Bob about this issue. And I'm like, I have no idea how to do this, right? How do I even have this conversation, right? So culturally, we've been taught to respect our elders, to do what our teacher says, to do what our parents say, to do what the policeman says, even if we don't agree or feel a little bit differently, and not to be brave. And again, always politely and respectfully. I would never tell someone to talk to a teacher or a parent or a policeman disrespectfully, but always politely and respectfully. It's cultural, right? So training, education are key factors that are missing that most people agreed with in the survey.
I would agree wholeheartedly. And I know I took one of those surveys, by the way. So it'd be funny to go back and see what my answers were now that we're having this conversation. I not only do I agree, but I would almost see you in raise that I think in many ways we're taught culturally not to be brave because of exactly what you just said. Do what your parents tell you, don't ask questions. Do what your teacher tells you, don't ask questions, on and on. And when you think about how they talk to us when we're young, and I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm a parent. You know, sometimes you get frustrated. You want the message to just get across, but it's what I do, what I need you to do, do what I tell you to do, do it now. And then if like, even my son now, sometimes he starts to ask a question, I feel myself getting frustrated. And then if I'm lucky, like, oh, my directions weren't clear. That's a good question for him to ask. I need to calm my ego down and answer the question. And what's funny is when I screw that up, he typically will yell back at me. And again, as a parent, It's like, I want to get on him for yelling at me. But when I see that like mounting on his face, he's like, you're not listening to me. I have to be like, there's like a 99.9% chance he's right. Like for him to react that way, I had to have missed something. Yeah. But is over, if we look at our generation and certainly I'm sure beyond, it's not just that I think you're right. We don't just teach people how not to be brave. It's almost we're encouraging them not to be. Just how many times was I told, just keep your mouth shut and do your job. Keep your mouth shut, do your job. Keep your mouth shut, do your job. And not by somebody who was oppressing me in any way, but that was just like, that's how you get ahead. You just keep your mouth shut, you do your job, and you earn your way through. When, as you said, all the way back in the beginning of this call, the culture of work has changed so much, not just generationally over the last 30 years, but the last 5 years, and it's certainly not done changing.
No. And in the book, as an FYI to you, Michael, and any of the readers, I do have the survey. So I have the questions I asked, 15 questions, and the answers. So people can see that they're not alone, that whatever it is that they're experiencing is very common amongst other business professionals and people, that the way they would have answered it is very consistent across the, you know, many cultures.
I'm very interested to see how those numbers stack up. I appreciate you taking the time today. I'm keeping an eye on the clock, and I know you've got some other things you need to take care of. So as we begin to wrap up, I would just love to ask you this. We covered a lot of, I'm assuming, the main points and themes of your book. But if there is one takeaway you would love people to have as they get prepared for their next brave conversation or their next bravery moment and their ability to take advantage of it, what would that big takeaway be for you?
I think the first would be that you ask yourself the question, are there any bravery conversations that I'm currently avoiding? I mean, there may not be, right? You might be in a good position where there aren't, but more people than not probably are avoiding a brave conversation. And it might be with a coworker, it might be with a spouse, it might be with a child, it might be with a parent, whatever. And so two things to do. One, ask yourself that question and think about it for a little bit. Don't just give yourself a quick answer, but think about it a little bit. And then find a few minutes to dump the ideas in your head on a sheet of paper. You know, get it out of your head. Because once it's out of your head and on a sheet of paper, and all that is on that paper are thoughts about this situation, your likelihood of doing something about it is greater.
I love them both. Thank you. So I can imagine people have listened to this conversation. They're taking notes. They want more. Where can people go to learn more about you, more about your work with Excellius, more about all three of your books, your podcast? Where can they continue to learn and connect with you?
The best place to go is my website, which is excellius.com, excellius.com. There's a link to each of the three books. There's a link to the podcast recordings, of which you are on there at least twice. You know, all that information is there, and a link to Amazon if you're interested in reading The Bravery Trip.
Fantastic. And I will make sure all of those links are in the show notes for people to access directly after they listen to the conversation.
Thank you.
It is always a pleasure to see you and to speak with you. Thank you so much for carving out the time this morning to be here. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. I thought we had a really, really great conversation.
I had fun. I enjoyed it. And I took a whole page of notes over here myself. So I'm imagining that people listening had to do the same. I wish you all the best with the book launch. Hopefully all goes very well for you. At the time of this recording, I think the book came out last week. So this is fresh. This is brand new for you. Really excited for you. Enjoy the launch and the journey. I can't wait to hear all the good things about the book. And I can't wait to see you again soon and continue these conversations in one form or another.
Right back at you, Michael. Thank you so much.
Take care. Be safe. Thank you. Ed, thank you so much for another wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you coming on my show this time and pulling back the curtain for us so we could see all of the research, the interviews, all of the work and effort that went into putting the bravery trick together. And of course, the techniques, the insights, and the outcomes that we can all apply in our lives as well. So thank you so much for sharing all of that. And of course, thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to the show today. Hopefully you enjoyed it as much as I did and took notes and put that book on your list as well. And when we think back about some of the important things that Ed spoke about, certainly when we talk about creating a culture that promotes bravery, plenty of leaders think they do it. but I don't know how many actually do, because their emotional responses, their inconsistency, their lack of follow-up, et cetera, could actually be discouraging these conversations far more than promoting them. The idea of asking for feedback, not just providing it the right way at the right time, but also consistently asking for it the right way at the right times, and the benefits that can have for relationships were really important. And also taking that systematic approach to these bravery conversations, as Ed refers to them. So we're putting a process in place. So we're focusing on the process and the outcomes, not our emotions and fears, to be more successful more often. Really, really appreciated that. So Ed, thank you again for everything that you shared. And let's thank our sponsors one more time before we go. We've got HumanTel. Please go to HumanTel.com and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off their online best-in-class training to identify when people's emotions are changing in real time based on evaluating their nonverbal behavior and changing facial expressions. It's backed by science. It's all out there. You can read it. I've done the training. I believe in it. Please head over to HumanTel.com and enter that code INCLUSIVE25. For the professional interviewers, head over to CertifiedInterviewer.com, and that's where you will learn all you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers, their networking opportunities, their educational opportunities, their interviewer resources, the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, what it takes to qualify, how do you pass the exam, maintain the designation, what it can mean for your career, all that and more over at CertifiedInterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to Inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized programs our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams, to provide them with the techniques necessary to obtain everyday confessions from their teams. They get more truthful information faster to do a better job solving problems and building relationships. All you need there at Inquasive.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening to the show. I truly appreciate it. Please like it, subscribe to the show, share the show, tell your friends about it, leave us your feedback so we can give you more of what you want to see and hear. I appreciate you all being here. Stay safe. Take care of each other. We'll see you next time. Thank you.